From WNIN, in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press, this is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Trend began as an experiment, a way to try out a different approach to covering local issues. It seems to be working so far, but that doesn't mean we ever want to stop experimenting. Each week, along with the interviews and the Arts Notebook, we step back from our local focus to bring you something informative and fun, and maybe unexpected on our B segment. Whether it's science, food, tech news, or essays, we try to make the B segment as fun for you to hear as it is for us to produce. With that in mind, consider this podcast our latest experiment. We've combed our archives and found a series of essays and stories that, together, address three of the most monumental topics in art. Some of them appeared in a past WNIN special called Love, some of them have appeared on The Trend's regular B segment, and some of them have never been heard before. This is a special edition of The Trend, Love, God, and Death. Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. Let's begin with love. In the spectrum of emotion, this might be the hardest to quantify. Fear occurs in virtually all animals. Anger often has traceable causes, but love? Love seems exclusive to humans, yet nigh impossible for us to define. We'll look at romantic love a little later, but right now, here's a look at familial love. Scott Salmon, our resident B-segment essayist, shows us how the love of a parent transcends the generation gap.
I don't see my son much. At 15, Austin is somewhat lost to me. A mysterious entity hidden beyond the bedroom door, indulging in his in-my-room phase. His sister Delaney calls the bedroom his lair, which makes sense since there is a wild animal quality about him. When I slip a new Rolling Stone or Mad magazine beneath his door, the magazine is yanked from view before it's halfway through, like a raw steak pulled by a lion's paw, and I'll hear a grunt. The problem with this in-my-room phase is it occurs in my house, which means I periodically must clean his kingdom. I am not a super parent like those who instill within their children personal responsibility when it comes to perpetually picking up after oneself. I lack the magic to turn my son into something akin to an algae eater. A few Sundays ago, with trash bag in hand, I opened Austin's door to take stock of his sanctuary of sloth. What can I say? The room was a trash heap. I'm going to need a bigger bag, I thought. I crawled through rubble, this teenage wasteland. Magazines were scattered about, including Mads dating back to June 2006. It's possible he stopped leaving his room once his first Mad arrived. I have renewed Mad thrice, and Rolling Stone. We both read each cover to cover. We are bonded by magazines, the mess reminded me. I uncovered dozens of CDs. Some were mine that he borrowed and presumably lost. He gets just as excited turning me on to a new band as I get turning him on to an old band. Music binds us, the mess reminded me. I found his lost wallet. Inside was a lost library card. I found two lost remote controls. I found a lost, nearly full container of Stridex beneath his bed. I found $3 worth of lost change. I found his lost chapstick. I found a lost book report. This is not a bedroom. This is a lost and found. I rescued many books from his messy floor. My son's love of books tells me that I have done something right as a parent. Books bind us, the mess reminded me. I found crumbled A&W cans, broken pencils, an empty Gatorade bottle, an obsolete keyboard, and DVDs. I found wrappers advertising Pop-Tarts, Airheads, Chewy Dips, Laffy Taffy, Combos, and Twix. I found a fossilized, half-eaten muffin and a lemon pie box. I found balled-up, clean t-shirts that he promised to hang. I found a clean, wadded sheet he promised to put on his mattress. I found dirty coffee cups he promised to return to the sink. I grew angrier over this room of broken promises. I found popcorn kernels, BBs, and pop rocks in the carpet. Would the vacuum cleaner explode if I sucked up the pop rocks and BBs together? I found a delete key, a tack, Hall's wrappers, a Big Mac container, a cockle burr, and broken sunglasses. I found dried cranberries with fuzz. It bothered me that each item, each piece of scrap, linked to something I purchased. There is a fine line between spend and spoil. I found loose photographs. One showed a Florida beach scene, my son wearing a spring break smile, telling me that maybe I wasn't a fully ineffectual father since I had provided the trip that provided this smile. The last photograph found was from grade school. He was 8, I think. He looked happy. His ears stuck out farther from his head then. He even wore a button shirt for the photo, a dressy style shunned not long after. I had forgotten this earlier, Austin. It was a wonderful moment. My eyes burned and grew wet. My intent was to simply clean the room of a boy I had in some way lost to time, but in so doing, I had somehow unearthed him from the clutter, each scattering a clue to his existence. I found him, too, in the simplicity of an old-school photo. My 2 hours in his room helped me connect the tame boy before the mess to the boy beast who made the mess. They're the same boy, my boy. I love them both. It was a pleasant reminder.
Scott Salmon will be back at the end of the show. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Love is trending right now on this special podcast edition of The Trend. There are those who believe that fate controls our lives, that those we fall in love with do so because they were destined to. And there are those who think that it's as random as a dice roll. Writer Dustin Michael found himself questioning the existence of fate when he stumbled upon an old journal.
So, as far as we know, my wife and I met for the first time on the night of August 10th, 2003, at a bar on an island off the coast of South Carolina. I say for the first time because we would meet again 4 years later and 1,000 miles away on a college campus in Missouri. And I say as far as we know, because in this particular case, there's evidence. A curious little note I wrote to myself that night. About 4 months after we started dating, I was stunned to find the note tucked away in an old journal. I showed it to my girlfriend, who is, of course, my wife now. "Oh my God," she said. "You're that guy from the bar." It makes for a cool story, how two people could reconnect after all that time without phones or Facebook, without even knowing each other's names. People who hear that story invariably say something like, "Wow, what are the odds?" I've never actually checked with a mathematician, but like everyone who's heard me tell the tale, I assume the odds are very small. But maybe they aren't. We were both headed for graduate school that fall, back in 2003. She was going to the Northeast, I was going to the Midwest. The grad school in English is a very small beach. It's not entirely unthinkable that we would both wash up in the same place. Our How We Met story is also a very romantic story, provided that no one notices the fine print details stuck to the underside of the narrative, like a price tag carelessly left on a Valentine's Day gift. Such is the fact that not only did we both fail to make a deal-sealing impression on that first fateful night in the bar, we also failed to even recognize each other the second time around. And then there's the note in my journal from the night I met the woman I would one day marry. One might expect a treatise on her beauty, her smile like the first fruit to tempt the lips of men, the unsounded swirl of galaxies in her eyes, her confident grace as she plied the dim air of the bar toward me, an expensive ship pulling into a sketchy port. Alas, only the phrase, "girl talking to me," followed by the scribbled name of a famous Pittsburgh deli and a list of the food served there. Coleslaw, tomato, French fries. But romance aside, I find that regardless of whether I'm telling my tale or listening to someone else's, the term most liberally tossed around in response to the "how I met my spouse" story is fate. In this instance, fate and destiny are evoked so universally that it's hard not to notice a paradox. Freedom and independence are all the rage these days, except when it comes to falling in love. There, predestination runs as straight as an arrow from the present all the way back to Cupid himself. And looking back at my own How We Met story, there's arguably a case for it. Personally, though, I find being fate's puppet a little unsettling. Downright creepy, even. It occurs to me I should get a second opinion about it. So I go ask my wife, whose name is Nisha, by the way.
Okay, so it's August 2003, and you walk into this bar, and you see this guy sitting there. And that guy is me, of course. But what's going through your mind when you came in?
Either this guy is a total phony, like sitting there writing in his journal like Hemingway or something by the sea, or he could be very interesting. And there's really only one way to figure out whether he's a phony or whether he's like the real thing, like an actual rugged Hemingway writer. And the only way I could find that out is to just come over and ask you. And so, of course, there's probably a little alcohol courage flowing through me anyway.
She picks up our daughter, who's 6 weeks old, and bounces her on her knee. I go at her with a harder question. Do you believe in fate?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't expecting this question. Yes and no. When presented with a story like ours, it kind of makes you believe in fate, even if you don't ordinarily want to. So I think, yeah, I think inevitably you can do your best to make the choices in your life and do what you're going to do. But there's a plan in some cases, and it's going to get you whether you want it to or not.
Is it reassuring to you to think that there's a higher power that's guiding our actions?
Yes. It feels nice to know that we're not always forsaken, kind of, you know, and doomed to deal with the consequences of choices we're making, because let's face it, we don't always make the best ones, you know.
You're saying that bouncing a baby on your knee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this was a good choice.
My wife turns, puts our daughter into her mechanical swing, and turns the knob. The gears groan, the seat rocks feebly forward. Then my wife reaches down and gives a tiny shove, and the infant pendulum settles easily into its forward and backward groove. Dreamily, our daughter gazes up from her swinging chair, as peaceful and unaware as if that nudge had come from the hand of fate.
More from Dustin Michael later in the show. This is a special edition of The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Each week, The Trend's B segment is produced by our associate producer and engineer Tony Voss, and a while back, he spent way too much time on a WNIN special called Love. As part of that show, Tony included this memory of lost love in the age of social media.
There's a horrible cliche that says that it's a small world, and that sometime years down the road, you'll run into somebody in the place you least expect, and see them after what seems like forever. Well, with technology and the internet and all those fancy things, the world is getting even smaller. You can move away, far away from where you used to be and start over. Become a different person. But sooner or later, something's going to catch up to you. It's for this reason that I hate Facebook. I joined Facebook a couple years ago because it seemed like that was the way that my friends were communicating now. They weren't using email, they weren't calling me on the phone, certainly. So I buckled under, and I signed up, and there I was. And it had been going fine for a while until they introduced a little feature called People You May Know. It's up in the right-hand corner of the screen. It shows you just a couple people. They're friends of friends. And they show you a picture and a name. It is annoying as hell. Because invariably, the people that it shows me, I don't know. Then 5 years after I ended, up to that point, the longest, biggest, most powerful relationship in my life, Facebook wanted to know if I would be her friend. That was odd to me, because I'm pretty sure that I remember saying something to her about how we would still be friends. Obviously, I thought at the time, the relationship had been so strong and so powerful and so meaningful to both of us that we would remain in contact. We would, through everything, continue to have a friendship. But when a relationship ends, it's like a cut on the inside of your mouth. It hurts. It stings constantly, and you can't stop poking at it. The only thing that will make it go away is to stop poking at it. So despite all the nice things I said, I stopped talking to my ex-girlfriend. I moved on. And now here was Facebook trying to force me to go back there. To honor the words that I had spoken 5 years ago. Add as friend. And don't I want to know what she's been up to? Don't I want to feel that connection again? Don't I want to honor a promise I made to someone who was so important to me, who I gave years of my life to, shared things with that I would never share with others? Isn't it time to be the friend I said I would be? Facebook has another feature. It's called Block This Person.
Tony Voss is The Trend's associate producer and a husband and father as well. You can find him on the PlayStation Network as Big Livin. This is a special podcast edition of The Trend, Love, God, and Death. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We move now to musings on God. That word means many different things to different people. Some believe, some don't. Some are still searching for answers. What we have for you here are not answers, but rather perspectives. We start with a fusion of God and love as Shauna Mefford and Rory Carroll approach the day of their wedding.
So we're getting married in 2 days, and the question of the rite of marriage and God has come up. We're having a private wedding, a rite of our own, a celebration of our love and our future life together. Keeping it a private affair took some doing. My family asked when and where it would be, but once I said it was private, they seemed okay. But I'm sure they were disappointed. My future in-laws seemed to take the hit a little harder. Some voiced their initial sadness. Others had to be talked down from showing up anyway. These nameless others had to be talked down during a layover on our trip to our wedding destination. We believe the crisis has been averted, but only time will tell. They wanted to be here to witness the religious rite of our wedding itself, although I'm fairly certain it would not be what they were expecting from either a religious or a civil ceremony. Our ceremony is one of our own creation, pulling from our own backgrounds, heritage, and belief, a sort of hodgepodge of tribal ceremony, Buddhist philosophy, poetry, prayer, pledges, and good wishes for our future. We both come from religious families, and our wedding is not a rite that one may recognize from the traditional canon of religious ceremonies, and the question arises, does God play a part in our wedding? My husband-to-be, in less than 48 hours, says that God and religion have nothing to do with each other. I understand this perspective, and I agree to a great extent. Organized religion, for the most part, has done everything it possibly can to replace God with people in the practice of faith. However, there is also a side of me that understands that we as human beings in the world need a sense of ritual, of rite, of marking the important moments. The wedding rite itself, a human invention, is inviting God to be present, and for the both of us to stand in God's presence, creator, energy, goddess, old dude with a white beard sitting on his throne, or what have you, and say yes. We are actively, consciously, emotionally pledging from this moment on to create something new of ourselves. It is a rite of passage, a point of transformation. We are no longer what we were, and we are asking God to witness and to be a part of this transformation. My husband-to-be, it's really more like 40 hours if I were to calculate more closely, is far more scientific-minded than I am, and as he sees it, God has no choice but to participate in our lives and in our wedding. He also mentioned to me that it may sound like blatant hubris, but to a scientifically inclined brain, that's the only way it works. To me, that sounds like you're going to Aunt Judy's and you're going to like it. That makes God sound like an 8-year-old boy who doesn't want to get yet another oversized sweater for his birthday and has already grown tired of having his cheeks pinched a little too firmly and a little too often by Aunt Judy. But being in the theater, I often see philosophical statements played out in my own invented context, complete with dialogue and background story, yet completely missing the point of the logic altogether for the sake of personal amusement or a good line. Husband-to-be. You know, by the time you hear this, we will already be married, so let's just call him my husband. My husband says marriage is... Well, how about he just tells you in his own words?
Well, I like to view marriage, or at least the ideal marriage, our marriage, as more of a cultural milestone than a religious one. And that is not to eliminate or at all downplay the role of God in this event, in our love or in our life. Maybe now would be a good time to elaborate on the God has no choice comment. To me, God is the idea that started the universe. God is everything, everywhere. God is not meant to take part in our love. He is our love. Every door I hold for my future wife, every meal I make to nourish our bodies, every look of admiration, whether or not it is noticed and returned, every simple act of kindness we perform for one another perpetuates this creative idea and renews it. The rite we'll be going through in a mere 39 hours is a testament to our love and commitment in the eyes of our closest friends, who witness and partake in the ceremony as representatives not of a religion, but of the civilization in which we live, a civilization which is richer for us having decided to take this step. The difference is we chose not to adhere to a divinely arbitrary set of rules governing the ceremony, but to let our own human intellect and instinct guide us in how best we can unleash the God in ourselves. I see that as being truly faithful. Or maybe it's just hubris.
So what part does God have to play in our wedding to me? The way I see it is this. God is our creator, ancestors, and the universe. God goes by several different names and has several different faces, and sometimes wears clothes and sometimes has no body. But regardless of God's incarnations or local flavor, in our wedding, God is in our hearts. Because in order to create or transform into something new, there has to be a creative spirit within the both of us. Even if he is 8 and tired of Aunt Judy.
Shauna Mefford Carroll is an assistant professor of theater. She co-founded Independent Actors Theater in Columbia, Missouri, and met her husband when she was casting a show for the theater company. Rory Carroll is a theater artist, musician, builder, Capricorn runner, and aspiring cowboy astronaut. He's studying physical therapy in Plattsburgh, where he lives with his very tall wife. God is trending on this special podcast. I'm Micah Schweitzer. It's rare that one feels godlike. Few things can inspire that thrill of omnipotence. Writer Dustin Michael is back to recall his brush with divinity.
In the beginning, I created the syllabus. The days on which I was supposed to lecture were without form and void, so I made a calendar that contained essays and reading assignments for those days, and I called the course Freshman Composition 1, for that was what I had been hired to teach. And I wrote it in the header of both the syllabus and the calendar. And I looked at the new documents I had created, and my spirit was hovering over the face of the new course. This is going to be way too easy for them, I thought. There is no possible way they can fail. Let me say first of all that in real life I don't have a God complex. I don't really conceive of myself as divine, even in the limited context of the English composition classroom. I'm an okay teacher, but by no means great, and when compared to even the most run-of-the-mill English majors, as a writer or a reader of literature, I'm a bit of a hack. But the students I recently taught were not English majors. They were all repeaters, freshmen who had failed the course before, sometimes more than once. And they weren't run-of-the-mill, even though their parents probably owned stock in the mill, in addition to the beachside condominiums and timeshares where the students almost all lived. To put it bluntly, my students were the children of affluent investors and business owners. They remembered vacationing near the college when they were younger and thought, hey, wouldn't it be sweet to earn a college degree in the place where we all used to chill out? Shortly after our introductions, I asked them to describe their favorite books. Nobody had one. They couldn't remember the last time they'd read a book. Seventh grade? Sixth? I asked them about their experiences in previous English classes. They said they'd failed them, but had been allowed to continue to advance through school because of the No Child Left Behind Act, a phenomenon they described as awesome. As I stood before them, absorbing this, confident in my ability to punctuate sentences and transition from paragraph to paragraph, I began to feel a bit, well, godlike. But that's not all. It wasn't long into the semester with this particular group of freshmen before almost all of them were failing. As a result, my email inbox was suddenly full of messages from students offering excuses, begging for forgiveness, and promising improvement in exchange for just one more chance. These desperate pleas would usually appear the day after an assignment was due, and invariably assumed the imperative tone of voice, familiar from such lines as, "Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses." Only it was more like, "Give me another week to turn in my article summary, and forgive me my absences for the 7 classes I skipped," or some version of that, repeatedly throughout the semester, from about 2/3 of the class. Give this, forgive that. No pleases, no thank yous, no question marks, with the exception of the one in the email I received one dark day, which read, "It's raining. Are we seriously still having class?" Finally, I was like, "Have it your way. You guys aren't participating in the dialogue of this class anyway, only making me field your stupid prayers. From now on, I'm handing stuff down from on high." Looking back, I'm aware that I came into the whole God thing from the wrong end. I opened up with approachability and forgiveness, but by spring break, I was all fire and brimstone. The real Almighty got it right, going in all hard and mean and then softening a tad in the New Testament. Not me, though. My initial easygoing, turn the other cheek on the syllabus policy infractions attitude hardened until whatever mercy I had was nailed to ultimatum and threat. "Show me 3 of you who actually did the reading," I thundered on at least one occasion, "and I'll spare the rest of you from a quiz." One time a girl tried to turn in a paper with a bunch of stuff copied straight from Wikipedia, and I straight up smote her for it. This other guy kept texting during class. Smote. No one dared foster a personal relationship with me. Not a single one of them friended me on Facebook. One of the biggest lessons I learned from my tenure as the deity is that by the time people ask if they're doomed, they usually are. Like, "I don't want to flunk this class," they would say, as tongues of flame all but licked their toes. "What can I do?" So I would tell them, "Find a way to be curious about what you've been assigned to work on. Force yourself to take it seriously. You didn't have much time to begin with, and now you have even less. But it's not too late." Some of the stuff I spouted off actually works well as good religious advice, too, such as, "Concentrate on the objective, not the punishment you get for failing to meet the objective. And try asking for guidance along the way, so that you don't have to ask for rescue." It got pretty deep. Additionally, I sometimes caught myself talking in parables and proverbs, usually ones rooted in wealth and the culture of privilege, because I assumed that's what they'd be familiar with. I'd say things like, "You think you deserve a B? You expect returns, but you haven't made any investment. Make an investment, and then you'll get returns." But very few of them got the returns that they wanted. Most realized, too late, that the thing that they had signed up for, which they assumed would be very easy and natural, was actually challenging and difficult. They realized it requires devotion, and contains complicated rules that carry consequences if broken. And yes, yes, there are rewards. But those rewards take time to appear, and they're hard to measure. As an instructor, it seemed like I never got around to instructing anything. And as a deity, it seemed like all I did was try to convince them that my message was important, and the rest of the time I was outlining the torments that awaited them if they did not embrace it. I spent most of my time defending my message against constant criticism and attack, and not enough time demonstrating how it can improve their lives in any practical way. Over the course of 3 months, some of my flock wandered off, never to be seen again, and I suspect some of those who remained did so purely out of fear of punishment. And me? I felt myself failing to care about this crap anymore. My life's work, I mean. I started to wonder what the point of all this is, anyway. It was as though I'd been remade in the image of some of my uninterested students. I started to wonder if God gets depressed. And I still would wonder that, I think, if it hadn't been for one student. She sat in the back of the classroom and rarely said anything, but she always showed up and took notes. Writing wasn't something that came easy for her, she confessed, but she was working at it because she wanted to get better. She revised her work with thoughtful, meticulous, painstaking edits. She applied the techniques she learned to her own interests. She located weaknesses in her drafts and sought out new ways to correct them. It was like watching someone rise into wakefulness from a long, deep slumber. Slowly, carefully, she emerged, bright, aware, and fully engaged. The first essay she turned in was okay. The second was good. But her third essay, an argument for why the university should not change its mascot, was such an elegant, well-reasoned, and luminous piece of prose, so ablaze with her own stylistic voice and the soaring music of her thoughts that the words seemed to spark from the surface of the page and ignite all the atoms of creation. When I handed back her paper, I asked for a copy to keep so that I could show others the excellence that they should aspire to. She smiled. Thanks, she said. This was a good class. Maybe I like writing after all. Thank you, I said to her, thinking to myself, maybe I like teaching after all. Then she turned and strode forth into the soft glow of summer and the promise of proceeding to the next required English course, leaving me by myself for the big epiphany moment, which, of course, I experienced from the ground, not from the sky. As the clouds parted from me and I gazed up toward heaven, all I could think of was that those same clouds also have to part for whoever's looking down.
Justin Michael and his wife Nisha recently both got their PhDs and are hard at work raising their daughter Avonlea. You can read some of Dustin's work at asininepoetry.com, the online repository for bizarre writings. You're listening to a special edition of The Trend, Love, God, and Death. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and now we come to the end. And as it will be for all of us, the end is death. No matter how you feel about it, death is inevitable. So it was for our B-segment essayist Scott Salmon's grandmother, and so it will be, Scott realizes, for him.
Last year, Grandma Lil, my mother's mother, died. She was 89 and had been holed up in a nursing home for far too long. It was a death mourned, yet one too that, based on her dwindling quality of life, brought relief to us all. It was one of those deaths. At the funeral home, before the lid was closed and sealed, I witnessed my crazy uncles put two items in the coffin. 5 Hoyle playing cards fanned in her right hand, Jack of Hearts, Jack of Diamonds, Queen of Hearts, King of Hearts, and Ace of Hearts, the perfect euchre hand if Hearts is Trump. A loner. And a cold can of beer smuggled in from the nearby KFC. Now, before you hastily judge what my uncles did as lowbrow, keep in mind that the writer Christopher Buckley, as reported in his memoir, Losing Mom and Pop, buried his father with a jar of his favorite peanut butter, along with his wife's ashes and a TV remote control. You'd be hard-pressed to name someone more highbrow than the Buckleys. A rosary in my grandmother's left hand was pressed to her chest. The grandsons were pallbearers. We carried our grandmother through the cemetery rain. The ground was a muddy mess. The dress shoes worn by my brother Pat were sucked from his feet by muck when we veered off course, as if the dead below played a practical joke. Seeing him standing with only his white socks showing in the mud caused my grief-stricken mother to laugh with surprise and exclaim, "Patrick's lost his shoes!" A few others chuckled. At least something good came from Pat's misfortune. The coffin lowered as Grandma Lil staked claim to her predestined 6 feet, which is one of life's few guarantees. Today, I still think about those other things buried with Grandma Lil. Her rosary, her cards, her beer. I still think she would have approved. Those three items summed up her simple life. Before the nursing home, she was a devout churchgoer and a fierce lifelong euchre player. And all through my life, rarely did I see her without a beer. She was that kind of grandmother. She enjoyed her life. I think about my own dirt nap now, one that hopefully won't begin for at least 4 more decades, pending my quality of life. What items summing up my life would be placed in my coffin? Here's my list. My worn paperback copy of The Stories of John Cheever, the best short story collection ever. My all-time favorite story written by anyone is in there, The Swimmer, which I first read on Easter break during college in 1987. I have read it every Easter since. While you're at it, toss in the first scholastic book I ever ordered from school, Arnold Lobel's Frog and Toads Are Friends, which hooked me on reading. It's very thin and won't take much room. A bag of Scrabble tiles. The hours spent playing Scrabble are some of the fondest hours spent here on earth. My opponents, some of my fondest people. My iPod filled with nothing but Van Morrison. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. Just like honey, baby, from the beach. How else will I be able to rest in peace? A picture of my son and daughter in the same photo, both smiling. There might be one in existence. There is a 5-year age difference between my offspring, so seldom are their smiles synchronized. If you find such a photo, I want a copy. Show me I've been a good dad. A pillowcase with that perfume scent I love to make me feel unlonely. A rosary for superstitious reasons. Who knows? Maybe that string of beads is the big key. Someone will have to buy me one, though, or at least run a thread through my Scrabble tiles. I have long believed Scrabble was sent here from heaven. And finally, a trusty crowbar, just in case I change my mind about the whole damn death thing. Who says you can't take it with you? Okay. So my casket will need to be a bit bigger than Grandma Lil's. If space is an issue, remove my shoes. You can give them to my brother Pat, a potential pallbearer. He might need a backup pair, especially if it rains. I hope it does rain. It seems easier to leave in the rain.
Scott Salmon lives in Jasper, Indiana, and performs regularly with the Will Read for Food Players. You can hear his essays frequently as part of the Trends B segment. That brings us to the end of our special podcast edition of The Trend, Love, God, and Death. We'd like to know what you thought of the show. Do you want to tell us you liked it? Do you want to tell us you hated it? Did it make you want to give us money? Well, good news. You can do all of those things by clicking on the trend at WNIN.org, where you'll find links for reaching us on Facebook, Twitter, and by email. This and other podcasts of The Trend are at WNIN.org and CourierPress.com. We're also on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. And likely since you found this show, you know some of that already, but we've got to cover all the bases here. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer at the Courier and Press. Tony Voss is the B-segment producer, and so most of this was his fault. Jeffrey Osman composed the theme music. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk next week.